Welcome to iPodcast Magic Missile, where we play games and talk geek. Broadcasting every week from the New River Valley in the beautiful mountains of Southwest Virginia, we bring you audio from some of the most exciting games, new and old. No actual wizard spells here, just actual play from great games. This is iPodcast Magic Missile.
And we're back!
That was also the, he is also cheating, where,
that was the underground boxing tournament.
Right, before the regular boxing tournament, there was an underground boxing tournament, which I guess was inspired because all those boxers were in town. The, underground boxing tournament was mostly based on cheating. Actually, the regular boxing tournament was mostly based on cheating as well. We had...
You're welcome.
We got all the party in on, participating because what happened is the boxer would go in there and every other member of the party would make a skill roll to support them in some way. Like a charisma roll to get the crowd cheering for their guy. A heel check to put their guy back together again.
Surreptitiously.
Yeah. Shooting into the other guy's eye or, you know, putting... Bengay in his jockstrap or something like that.
It was difficult between rounds.
Anyway, there were, you know, you could sabotage the other side. And they got to practice this a little bit in the underground boxing tournament, which was much more cheatier. I guess, you know, I had a bunch of boxing guys in town, so that must have been a thing that made sense to me to happen. But the party managed to, you know, the party was cheating their ass off, but they were hiding it well. The other guys... were also cheating and hiding it well, but eventually the secret got out. I guess Bison must have seen something.
We kept telling him, Bison, don't tell anyone what we're doing. But isn't this cheating? Yes, but it's okay. Just don't tell anyone we're cheating. Don't tell anyone that we're cheating. You know how we're cheating? Don't tell anyone that we're cheating. Okay, Bison, don't tell anyone...
Will is good for this. This is, of course, the same Will from the Apocalypse World campaign that you, handsome and elegant reader, are used to listening to every week.
Again, reading a podcast.
I just can't noun this podcast right, can I? So the...
it's actually a verb.
Will has a tendency, of course, to throw monkey wrenches into his own works for hilarity. Something that 4th edition players just aren't used to doing. I mean, generally in 4th edition, people are very optimized, very focused on optimization, you know... perfect play type strategy. It's so video game like that, you know, it just inspires that behavior in people. So it was
dear reader, you can hear me rolling my eyes.
It was obnoxious, but also really beneficial to the campaign at large to add Will, because he did pull the rug out from under all the entire party so often. Just, you know, stick his head right in that closing water resistant bulkhead.
That cost me a daily.
So
not to become Bison Threelin.
And this was kind of expressed by Bison being a little bit, shall we say, dim-witted, somewhat oblivious to what was going on around him, just like the main character of One Piece. I mean, it's a big driver of the plot of One Piece that Luffy just sticks his head in a problem hole and says, "Hey guys, get me out." And, you know, the rest of the party is like, "Well, Luffy's going to go get himself into some trouble. I guess we better go get him out again.
He has the keys."
So that was why they went so out of their way. They were like, Bison. And by Bison, I mean Will, the player Will, who I am within melee range of and have already been looking for an excuse to hurt. Do not out us for cheating. We're in a room full of guys with two or more facial scars. There is a foot of, you know... opaque cigar smoke at the ceiling. This is exactly the kind of situation where 5 people do not want to start a fight with 55 people. And he was good. He managed to not out them until he caught the other guy cheating. And he said, "Hey, he is also cheating." At which point I think they picked up the ring and threw it at you.
It was an interesting mob mechanic. We just considered every square to be difficult, threatened terrain.
Yeah. The just attacks of opportunity coming out of the air. The air, which, of course, was filled with punching guys. The a little while after that, we got to the point... Oh, right. It was actually right after that, yep. Wasn't it? Where everybody had these backup characters. I guess you started this trend. Everyone was making these backup
Always
characters.
Always have a backup.
Making characters in
D&D. I have a backup for my goblin in a campaign that hasn't started and won't for 2 weeks.
Making D&D characters is fun, you know? And, like, you know, Heiko always likes to have backups. So
as long as you do it right, read my blog.
Everybody had a number of characters in waiting that they wanted to use. And we were also, at that time, we were adding your wife because James had pretty much dropped out. Duncan dropped out at the same time, right? Because he, James, and Warren all died in the same fight.
Spoilers.
How is that a spoiler?
For later in this story.
Oh. No, I think it's now. I think we're there.
Oh, okay.
The, we're like, man, so I thought, you know, with all these great characters, and people, you know, everybody designed their characters, so they kept talking about them, they really wanted to use them. We got to this idea of, hey, what if... Because, you know, the crew in One Piece is 9 people. Well, we're obviously not going to have a 9-player D&D party, even if I could find 9 people to be in my campaign.
Table's just not big enough.
Yeah, it just doesn't work that way. You can't do that. But what if you had the same player control 2 characters? And that way you could have twice as many characters in the pirate crew as you had players. And everybody could, you know, use all their fun characters. It basically would be like everyone can have twice as much fun.
You can send a whole bunch, keep a whole bunch of people on the boat and just form an away team where each person has a character. You could split the party and go on 2 arcs at once.
Which is actually a thing that happens a lot in the show.
And you can mix and match. You don't have to have party A and party 1. You can say, well, okay, let's, these 2 characters are going to switch. It means sometimes this party doesn't have a healer. That's just funnier.
Arguably, this is when this campaign actually got good, like real good, because the best thing about the 8-man, 4-player dynamic, and I shouldn't say 8-man, because we actually had excellent gender parity, much better than the actual One Piece crew. In fact, did we have 4 girls and 4 guys?
It was 50% until we got our 9th and 10th character, and then right. It was still 40%.
Yeah, so it was 50-50 because Will played 2 boys and Dave played 2 girls and the High Coves,
as I do,
played a boy and a girl each.
As we do in real life.
The we also had 50% fruit users and 50% not fruit users.
We call them fruisers. Well, I call them fruisers.
Yeah. It's really just One Piece, power comes from magic fruit. And the
just like the real world, organics.
The crew in the comic has...
it's real close.
They have 4. They have 4 fruit users, 4 non-fruit users, and Frankie. The important thing about fruit users is that they cannot swim at all, ever. It's like water is kryptonite to them. Just touching it renders them usually paralyzed, unable to use their superpowers.
So it was a good idea to have a party with some people who did that and some people who didn't.
This actually came in... This is another reskinning handy thing, because we did... Water... We decided would do damage. I mean, like, you know, obviously just touching water is going to do damage, like lava does fire damage. But if you got hit by water, or if you were a fruit user and were therefore taking damage from some water-based thing, we needed a type for it. And One Piece doesn't have a whole lot of force fields, but it does have all this water-based damage happening.
Or does it? Spoilers.
So we made water damage be force type. And this was super handy because in 4th edition, a lot of stuff that is meant to... bypass resistances, like damage resistances, is force type. In the world of One Piece, many people who have damage resistance because of a fruit power, which is explicitly bypassed by hitting them with water. So that actually was one of the things about the reskin that worked really nicely. But anyway... Eventually.
Yeah, we figured it out after the beginning of the campaign.
One of the...
we figured out for Schooner.
I feel like that story bears telling, because it's hilarious as balls, but everyone else tells me this character was terrible.
It was.
I introduced a character named Captain Schooner, who had the sweat fruit power, allowing him to sweat in a projectile manner, such that he could rocket around in the air, or blow his enemies away with waves of...
It's like that commercial where the guy...
It's for some kind of antiperspirant.
Yeah, where he's shooting jets of water out of his armpits.
Yeah.
And it's exactly how it worked. We were all sitting at the table going... Yeah.
That was pretty gross.
That was pretty gross.
Oh, you hit me. Oh, it's unavoidable. It's a status effect.
Yeah. He had a couple blasts and bursts. So what we were talking about before is one of the things that made the campaign get really good when we added the... one of the things that the new dynamic with having all these players was or having all these characters is they had all these different personality interactions, and it would be like, oh, so and so likes so and so but doesn't like so and so. Dave's secondary character after Ophelia, he had Amy,
who was a Texas cowgirl sniper and a bit of a hothead.
Yeah. Ended up in a rivalry with Heiko's backup character. Well, I guess not backup character. His new main character, new Tomiko. Main character. Yeah.
Who was also a female combat-heavy hothead.
Yep. Although she was definitely more the blue Oni to Amy's red Oni.
Which is terrifying, because she was the red Oni to my original character's blue Oni.
It's true.
But
she was the other character who could drop 200 damage on someone in a round.
That's true. But and it was just a ton of fun throwing them together because, you know, they'd be all, like, snarking at each other. And then towards the end of the campaign have, like, you know, a great bonding moment.
It was one of those truly great rivalries where we were alike in the ways that made us hate each other, but different in the ways that gave it fuel. So we were both, you know, damage dealers, but one was ranged and one was close. But we were also both very nimble, but one of it did it with martial arts powers and one of them did it with science.
Another good interaction was Laura, Heiko's wife, joined the campaign at the same time we added the second party. So she actually came in with two characters.
A couple of sessions apart.
Were they a couple? I think yeah, they were one
Klusk,
session apart.
No, Klusk was one, came in at least one or two sessions before
we had to escape from Sandal.
Yeah, and when you were escaping from Sandal Island was when you met the second party.
We met the second party on Seabump.
Which was the island after Sandal.
It's a week passed between sessions.
Okay, well, I'm not going to argue with you about it anymore.
They were different arcs. Wikipedia will back me up.
Fair enough. But, yeah, so Klesk was, like, the youngest member of the party. I think Klesk was supposed to be 14. He was a boy that transformed into a griffin, because Laura super loves griffins. Let me tell you what.
But she also, even more than griffins, loves slave pit fighting.
I don't think that she does.
Then why did she make a griffin slave pit fighter? Quid pro quo.
That's not what that means.
It isn't that.
Anyway.
Suddenly you're a Latino.
So yeah, Laura's primary character, Klesk, which joined the party at that time, ended up having a really cool relationship with Dave's primary character, Ophelia. Ophelia, who had lost a younger brother that would have been about Klesk's age. Or, no, maybe it would have been much older.
A few years older than that, probably, okay. But
the point is, Ophelia was very motherly, and, like, a big part of her character arc was her coming to terms with her brother's, you know, her younger brother's death. So, like, Klesk, on the other hand, needed mothering, like, badly.
His whole gimmick was fighting alone.
Yeah. So, they had a really good mechanic where Klesk would be like, I don't understand what's going on, and, you know, Ophelia would, like, try to be protective of him and nurturing of him, but then, you know, sometimes they had to turn him loose and kick some ass. Were there any good, other good ones that worked there?
Direct interactions?
Yeah.
I think Jay didn't like when Ophelia set alcohol on fire. Oh.
Jay started
Tom
out...
Tom had an interesting interaction with every female member of the party.
Yes.
But when we describe those characters.
Well, I think that's where we are now.
So okay. Katara had...
Oh, right. Katara kind of had a thing with Jay, because she was super uptight and, like, everything needs to be neat and nice. And Jay...
I thought she was better than everyone else. Katara was a fishman princess.
Yeah.
Or noble woman.
Katara fell into a very convenient portion of the campaign where our captain had died. And a couple of people looked at it and looked at who should be captain now. Well, we looked at Ophelia and said, Ophelia's the longest-lasting member of this party and the most level-headed. She would make a good captain. But Tomiko is the most close to our original captain and wants to be captain. But Katara also wants to be captain.
Mostly just out of self-importance.
But Bison is the best fighter, and that makes you captain in the world of One Piece. Four characters, each with a different player.
Wanting to be the captain somehow.
Or in some way angling for it, yeah. However unintentionally.
I remember you had a really great way of describing the difference between Warren and Tomiko's attitude on the captaincy.
Warren, I wanted to play the leader of the party as somebody who didn't boss anybody around. Somebody who helped other people do things. You know, like a good boss, not...
Right.
A manager, not a boss. Mm-hmm. A leader, not a... boss.
Tyrant.
Yeah. So that, however, manifested as generally not having an opinion. Just, well, let's put it up to a vote. It's like, well, then why do we even have a leader? Tomago, however, was all about being in charge until things got hard. Then it was a democracy. So Warren actually wanted the responsibility of being the leader, but none of the power. Whereas Tomoko wanted all the power of being a leader, but none of the responsibility.
Once we brought Warren back to life, which was actually when the campaign ended, it would have been kind of neat to have the two characters, now the married couple, play the dual captaincy. Warren for the responsibility and Tomoko for the bossing around.
Things are getting hard. Tag in.
Did you have something to say?
Oh, no, or you could just have Luffy be the captain.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, we ended up kind of settling upon Bison.
Yeah.
I wanted Heiko to be the captain because I felt like of all the players we had, because, you know, the original lineup was a weird combination of players. And I thought that of these players, I know that Heiko is the one who will definitely, definitely not abuse being put in a position of character power over the other characters. And that's why I wanted you to be the captain. I know that you did not want it. You worked it into your character.
He was too right.
Yeah, I was.
Therein squats the toad.
Which brings us to Tom. Hyun Tai Tom.
I think it was Tom Hyun Tai.
Okay, when you told it to me, it was Hyun Tai.
People kept calling him whichever name didn't make sense.
Right.
He was a ninja, sort of.
He was dressed like a ninja.
His backstory was only vaguely explained because he didn't have much of a backstory. His gimmick was, yeah, I shuffle around from pirate crew to pirate crew. I don't have an Nakama.
My job is to be support.
I'm the navigator. However, one reason I don't have an Nakama is because I already have an Nakama. Tom's power was the 9-9 fruit, where he would, at apparently random intervals, change personalities from the base person he was to one of the 9 spirits that inhabited his head based on the pantheon I wrote in college.
This is a D&D pantheon, so it's based on the 9 alignments of 3rd edition.
So after a fight, I would just roll a d10, and today I'm chaotic evil. And that was a lot of fun, playing 10 personalities.
That, you know, go between them. The combat always knocked you back into personality 0.
So that I could manifest them all as a spirit.
Right.
But
that was combat powers involved sending each individual spirit out and doing something to somebody.
Each personality had different interactions with the party. Like, nobody liked the green one because that was the torturer and the intimidator.
He came in useful at least once, though.
I rolled a 2.
I remember coming in for real useful at least once.
I think the least favorite, however, was the chaotic evil one. I would always specify by rolling a die, looking at it, confirming that it was in fact 4, just looking at Dave and going, ladies.
Yeah, the super amorous personality that was always trying to hit on all the female members of the party.
But not the charming amorous. Like the...
sketchy amorous.
The top 4 buttons undone to show off the medallion amorous. I think Ophelia went out of her way to get into fights when that guy was around, knowing it would kick me into another personality.
She did bop you with her staff a couple of times.
I remember the super fast talky one too. That one was fun.
That one was super excitable. He thought everything was interesting, and everybody was interesting because he was incredibly curious. And it would be great if we could investigate what everybody's fruit power did, because everybody's fruit power has these weird interactions. I wonder what could actually beat somebody who turns into a griffin. What is a griffin weak against? Is it rocks? I bet a griffin's weak against rocks.
Anyway, what was another one?
Rock the geographical feature, not the giant bird. Because, of course, you know, a griffin would be weak against a giant bird because a griffin is just a smaller bird, but it's also part lion. Do lions eat birds? I know lions are a type of cat, and cats eat birds, but only if they can catch them.
Who was Orange? Why do I remember Orange as being a woman?
Because Orange was a woman.
Okay.
What was the point of that one? Miss Andry.
Oh.
There you go.
Well, then.
That might be why.
What did we do with the... So let's see here now. What was the next point with that? Oh, right. I suppose the next funny thing that happened after the expansion to 8 players...
We're missing a party member.
Jay.
Well, he was the one that... I mentioned him. He interacted with... Oh, but we should probably describe him, though.
Jay's theme was hobo.
Yeah. He was a hobo with cardboard armor and a shaking knife.
And a drinking problem, in that I'm not drinking right now. For some reason, he was a prospector.
The chain was for fighting. The knife was a talking knife.
Oh, all right, this is my talking knife.
Diplomacy. It didn't work. Bluff.
Now it's better.
Jay was eventually cured of his drinking habit and became the most interesting man in the world.
Yeah, that was the best part, because a big thing about Jay was his big, bushy beard. He had a big, bushy white beard, you know, as a hobo, and a pot on his head.
Yep.
For obvious reasons.
But then once he got sober, he suddenly became a parody of the most interesting man in the world. You know, I think that ad campaign might have started during the One Piece campaign.
Nope.
Really?
Yep.
I'll take your word for it.
It started in, like, the 40s.
You're better at time than me when you tell the truth, which isn't often. Is that everybody? Klesk, Katara?
That was everyone.
Jay and Bison.
Jay was one of the examples of, yeah, we'll reskin, but sometimes we'll just throw stuff out the window. We're going to give Jay resistance to poison. Because his blood is mostly alcohol.
Yeah.
We're also going to give him vulnerability to fire. Because his blood is mostly alcohol.
That's true. That was the campaign was well ripened at that point, and I felt more comfortable making just like caveats like that. And I figured
it was awesome.
And also, I think his vulnerability was like more than his resistance. It was like resist 5, vulnerable 10. So, you know, it was pretty. Yeah. It was definitely a drawback.
He wasn't an unbalanced character.
No. So, of course, if you put 5 drawbacks on the table and tell Will to pick one, he'll be like, "I can only have one."
He was. Jay was the grabby fighter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was real good at sticking
to people.
I forget
what race that his thing was, but yeah, that was...
He was a dwarf.
He was a dwarf. Oh, perfect.
He was slow.
And hard to knock down.
I had no idea he was a dwarf.
Drunken master of fighting! Okay, well, this time!
it was so that he would be hard to pull. Oh, remember that time he, like, lifted an entire boat out of the water and hit another boat with it?
We did some naval combat. Rules for this don't exist, or if they do, they're trash, because this is D20, and that's what naval combat is in D20. Trash. So
they've tried it so many times.
And they've never got it right.
No.
Neither have you, but you got it more right than they did.
Oh, thanks.
So one thing we looked at was these individual people have to matter in naval combat. You can't just fight with cannons, because that's not very One Piece-y.
And you also just can't have the driver, like the pilot of the ship, be the only person that matters, because, you know, that leaves the other 3 players or 4 players out.
So we ended up saying, okay, we have combat range and we have naval combat range, much like first edition, where you had interior and exterior ranges for spells that were different.
Mm-hmm.
And in this one, everything is still measured in squares, but those squares are much bigger. So if you have a range attack that goes 5 squares, well, now it goes 5 naval combat squares. So it doesn't, you know, go for a quarter of a square and peter out.
I think one of those squares, I think one naval combat square was 50 squares.
It was either 10.
Was it 10?
I think so.
It was 10 squares, which was 50 feet.
Yeah.
That's what I remember.
That makes sense.
Because we had little boat minis. I broke out my little assemblable boat miniatures from Pirates of the Spanish Main, an old WizKids game.
So, sometimes it mattered. Amy's sniping was phenomenal. Because it did limit her to 3 squares. So also, she could just sit in the crow's nest and knock out every crow on the opponent's nest.
Also, you could use the cannons. You use a cannon as a weapon with your own, like, weapon-using powers. That was one of the more fun things about
it. Is either a melee with a range of 3 or a range with a range of your normal range. So,
A range of 10. The cannon was a weapon with range 10 melee and range 2. Range 10 range and range 2 melee. Yeah. You had to get right up on somebody to use a melee power.
Where Jay got interesting was that he was a grabby fighter. Well, people in One Piece are narratively strong. So it was not out of the realm of possibility for him to reach out, grab an enemy boat, and arrest its momentum. At least we tied it to this boat, so they had to drag it around. Where it got weird was the time he decided, I'm tired of this boat. So he used his throw power, which is take a guy and move him 6 squares. Well, this one was take a boat and move him 6 squares. Well, 3 of those squares were land.
Just threw that schooner 150 feet inland, and it was like, now chase us, you assholes.
I remember Will feeling bad about that afterward, and
nobody else
feeling
bad about it.
We were right.
That was flailingly awesome.
We're not going to do that every naval combat. We're going to do that now because it's funny, like Roger Rabbit.
Sometimes, however, I remember sometimes we would actually mix the systems, and it didn't make a whole lot of sense. We used naval combat for you guys to have to deal with a sea monster one time. And Tomiko jumped off the boat in order to grapple the sea monster. And then Dempsey rolled him in the back of the head.
Funny thing about 4th edition, if you go prone, you immediately fall to Earth at faster than terminal velocity. Narrative velocity. This is just how it's written. They don't explain what happens when you go prone while swimming, but they do suggest maybe you should drop to the bottom of the ocean, we're just saying. So, in theory, as long as I was on that monster's head, I could keep it pinned at the Mariana Trench. What's it gonna do? Eat me? I'm on the back of its head.
It was pretty, it was a lot of fun. Those naval segments were infrequent, but very enjoyable.
I believe that fight ended, and correct me if I'm wrong, with Ophelia draining the entire sea monster of blood, inflating like a balloon, and then launching the ship on a jet of sea monster blood into sea bump.
I'm gonna allow this.
Yeah, I do remember the... I do remember
that was the thing that happened.
So there we go. Now we had a fight between Klesk and Katara. So ha 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 ha.
I remember when you guys hit Seabump, you definitely hit it at speed.
Yep.
Because you ended up airborne and, like, crashing. Oh, right. That's what you guys went down the hole in the middle.
Yep.
This island was a big bump in the ocean with a hole in the top.
It's basically an anthill of water.
And, yeah, the water went up the hole, but only up the sides of the hole. This is actually a totally reasonable thing in One Piece, no matter what physics has to say.
Because One Piece has a very loose definition of reasonability.
Water went up the sides of that hole and then poured down the outside. So if you rolled up on it, it looked like just a big bump in the sea, hence the island name Sea Bump. And
oh, I just got it.
Right. When they got to the bottom of that hole, there was actually a little village in there. I remember you guys got the ship fitted for submarine travel, another thing that happens in One Piece. You could just make a regular ship sail underwater.
We got this shortly after the manga described how you actually do that.
Yeah, that was one of the things about this campaign, because the manga's still ongoing. And it was actually a big constraint on the campaign, the canon of the manga. I wanted to make sure that it was, like, very honest to the canon of the manga.
Or I'd shoot him.
Well, I, you know, that's the thing I care about, too. You didn't need to threaten me.
Not as much as your own health.
Anyway, the, waiting for Oda to explain things he had foreshadowed was a major element of the campaign's choices for timing. And by choices for timing, I mean stalling. So, like, for example, as soon as he explained how that, you know, submarine boat travel worked, boom, the party could do it. And I was super happy to be able to do that.
We were so bad at it.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember when the guys first did it, you were like, ah, make a nautical check. Clatter, clatter, clatter. Boat turns 90 degrees and goes straight down into the water.
Pretty sure it went backward.
Embedding itself, the water was only 30 feet deep, so it actually embedded itself halfway down in the sand.
Do we want to talk about the 9th and 10th party members?
Well, this is the thing that I get, because Oda just is great like this. He introduced a race of people in One Piece with two sets of elbows. They're called the Long Arm Tribe. And they just, you know, where your normal wrists would be, they have another pair of elbows and then another pair of forearms, and then that's where their hands are. So we had a monk join the party. And this was actually not reskinned. He was a D&D monk, and he was a One Piece, like, kung fu fighter. Long Arm Sloth combat style.
You may not think of sloths as having much of a combat style. That's because you never fought a sloth. Or actually know about them. It could be because you actually know about sloths. But the point is, they're terrifying as long as they're monks.
Yeah. This is a guy that joined after we did the two party thing, or the two character thing, so he joined with two characters at the same time. This other character, that was Vlaka, right? The other character was Oziak, or Oziak.
Doesn't matter.
It depends on who did the translation this week.
Right.
Who's your scanlator?
Irish terrorist sticky guy.
Glue-based terrorism.
I remember he had like skills with making bombs, though. That was definitely a thing that Oziak had. And the mini, we never did get a mini for him. I used like a HeroClix mini, which was just like a burglar with a sock hap and a crowbar.
We didn't end up getting a picture for him either. Everyone else got a custom portrait. Oziak's was Paste Pot Pete.
I had a lot of fun. And later, the Trapster.
I'm not sure he was Irish. I think he was Irish on paper, but his accent changed based on whatever media we had most recently consumed.
Yeah, he definitely. But
and for a while, he was Foghorn Leghorn.
No, that was Vlaka. Vlaka was.
Yeah, well,
that
makes Vlaka was Foghorn Leghorn.
Vlaka's another one of those characters.
I say.
joined the campaign and saw everybody doing their funny accents. You know, Amy with her deep Southern fried Texas accent. Bison with his hilarious Russian accent. Jay with his crazy drunk hobo accent.
Haku sometimes talking like he's on late night radio.
But the, so I guess he figured that, you know, when in Rome, I need to come up with some accents. But
just like, yeah.
Wasn't terribly good at it. So the accents ended up being a bit of a burden.
Locke is another one of those names that would be different based on the scan later, because I'm certain
there's no way to render that name in any way in Japanese.
No, we looked at it with like Vlaka. Brock. His name is Brock.
Yeah.
That must be it.
Yeah.
4 syllables, 5 letters.
Brock. Which ended up working out nicely. Anyway, so he was kind of fun. He would spin around with his long arms.
Wait, Quest was 4 syllables, 5 syllables. Kuresiku.
Ozayak was a... What is that? A seeker?
Yeah, he was a seeker.
He was a seeker. One of the, like, redheaded stepchild classes of 4th
like
edition.
Gloves like seeker.
I'm not saying there's anything wrong with Seeker, but it was a non-psionic class introduced in PHP 3, right? Which meant it, by definition, had the least support of any class, because the book it came out in only supported every class besides it and Rune Priest.
If you've ever watched the show, his fighting style was something like number 2s.
Run away and, like...
Glop you.
Yeah.
Possibly build a shell of hard...
Yeah, he had a move. That's Mr. 3.
He had a
Mr.
move.
Mr. 3, rather. Yeah,
he had a move named Igloo.
His move was a lot like cross dressing. Like, no.
Yeah, he had a move named Igloo where he made an igloo out of glue.
His gimmick was crippling inability to perform a single action.
Oh, right.
He was a masterful sniper by accident. He would shoot at a wall that would then dissolve, dropping an entire, platoon of pigs onto the Marines that were chasing us and their tanks, weak against pigs. And he would go, dang it, I was aiming for the general.
Dang it, I was aiming for the general. Like, that's what he sounded like. He was doing John
Underwater?
Lennon. He was doing John Lennon when he was trying to do the accent for Ozayak. Because I know that Ozayak was Irish because of the terrorism.
He might as well have named every crit critical miss.
The other feature of Ozayak's fighting style was that he would attempt to get as far away as possible because he had near infinite range and he never got hurt.
And he was sticky. He would like climb to the top of trees.
He would walk up a wall.
Yep, yeah. Being 21 squares away was too far. Being 19 squares was too close.
This was a thing Amy could do. But Amy spent the first 6 rounds of combat in melee.
Yep.
Because she was crazy.
And it was just more fun that way.
Yes.
Like, was a little bit too force conditioning.
So she could flank.
He played in encounters mostly, so... You know
what? Being a controller is harder, too.
Yeah.
You don't have that sudden escalation, now I'll do 40 damage a round. No, you go all the way up to 6 damage a round, but instead of slowing, you immobilize.
He also did the, he had that move, face sinkhole.
Oh!
Yeah, glue pot. He had, like, make a patch of glue, but it was, it was a reskin of Faye Sinkhole, and I remember Faye Sinkhole.
Faye Sinkhole is one of those moves that can single-handedly ruin a Delve Knight. That was Ozayak's escalation. When things were bad, Faye Sinkhole.
Remind us one day to tell that when we're doing some Delve Knight stories, because there's like probably a dozen story times just out of Delve Knight stories.
Oh, story times. I'm thinking there's probably a dozen stories. I'm like, no frick.
No, there's a dozen story times of because Delve Knight is just loaded with hilarity, but I remember that Faye Sinkhole, somebody, in fact, you know what it was? Dropped Faye Sinkhole in the fight with all 3 of the machine top brass at the same time.
I wasn't there that week. Yeah. It's a good thing.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure if the next round...
Killed by hit point damage.
I'm pretty sure the next round... That's it in the story. The next round, the one that wasn't stuck came and just basically punched him into a bloody pulp.
It was so goddamn satisfying, too. It was like, oh no, the 2 guys started... Whip! Boom! And just took him out. He's like, I will not suffer that fucking face. And you know what else? The face sinkhole sticks around. He being unconscious prevents him from using the free action that it takes to suck a guy back into it. But as soon as he woke up, that sinkhole was still active. That is a daily from PHB 3. Ugh. Anyway. The
long story short.
Yeah. Well, long story short. Too late. So that was the full 10-man party when we added Vlaka and Ozayak. And that was when... I feel like one of the best arcs, despite the puzzles in that campaign, was Yomiki Island. What had happened was because a bunch of characters had died when we did like the character changeover, 2 players leaving, 1 player changing to another character, I killed their 3 characters. They went on a mission to go to the afterlife and get their souls back so that they could come back
to
life.
Which was conveniently a way for Blake to sidestep canon, since there's very little about the afterlife in One Piece.
It was a filler arc.
Yeah, it was a filler arc.
But I buried the players in hell for months and months and months while I was waiting for Oda to work his way through those goddamn flashback arcs.
And after we were done in hell, we went to the afterlife. Those puzzles actually weren't bad for the parts where I was conscious.
I thought that, like I said, I feel like they were good puzzles, but one...
Dear reader, do you know what a sleeper hold feels like? I do.
The, oh right, I forgot about Laura choking you out there.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that made the puzzle hard.
The,
It's like, hey, Heiko, what do you think of this puzzle? I was like, I don't know, I'm spending all my threads right now on pumping blood.
I made a bunch of puzzles based on Buddhism, the 108 paths, but I...
And it felt like it.
But I didn't reckon upon the fact that... I was thinking D&D campaign has puzzles. Oh crap, I haven't done very many puzzles so far. Last time I tried, I drove a player out of the campaign. That was Duncan. He had no patience for that memory game at the sniping contest. No patience. So
But you like puzzles, right?
Yeah, I like puzzles.
You're going to like next week's session.
Yes, I love puzzles. I feel like they're an inherent part of Dungeons & Dragons, but they really didn't belong in the One Piece campaign, because they do not have puzzles very often, and when they do, they almost certainly cut them in half.
It's no JoJo.
Yeah.
It's barely even Hunter's Honor.
Well, the fights are frequently puzzle-y type fights. On Yomiki Island, though, I did get to introduce Pirate Bluebeard and the Bluebeard Pirates, and they were probably the most One Piece-y bad guys that I hit you guys with since the Karate Atoll.
I don't know, dear reader, if you've listened to my blog, but I put up a post recently about having players design things. Generally improv. I started it with, you know, players ask about a room and we fill things in together. I also said, have the players design some NPCs. This is what Blake did. He came up with the loose idea of some NPCs, gave us some stats end of list... Just distribute them around the table?
I made up little stat blocks like a monster in a monster manual, and I handed each player the monster stat block for their guy.
And just said, we're going to have some scenes with these guys, as One Pieces want to do, to introduce these villains.
Yeah, because I, like...
Just play them.
One of the things that was slowing us down a little bit, I felt like constraining the One Piece-iness of the campaign, was that in One Piece, frequently the viewer will see the bad guys scheming or doing something, right? This is typical in fiction, but in a D&D campaign, everything tends to be from this point of view of the heroes. So if the heroes aren't looking over a cliff to see the bad guys, you know, monologuing to each other, there's no way to get that kind of character development for your bad guys. And I had this epiphany, I don't remember what... I'm sure I didn't come up with it myself.
Headwind charge up.
I think we talked about it.
Right. Well, anyway.
I know you and I discussed
it. Assigned each player a bad guy... And had them run the bad guy. I remember that Alfred had, you know, more recently joined, and us being somewhat concerned about Alfred's role playing capability, gave him. I had assigned him the monkey, and he was like, "Why did I get the monkey?"
A jetpack that ate the monkey fruit.
Yeah, a jetpack that could translate. Is that just one of those One Piece things? It's like, why doesn't that joke get old? It defies aging. We've done it 4-5 times, and it just keeps on paying off.
That monkey was a lot of fun to play, though.
Zigzag, jetpack yep. Monkey.
Heiko got that one. And he did charades to communicate.
Because as a monkey, he could not speak.
And he moved fractally. It was awesome.
Zigzag had a movement of 20 squares flying with the jetpack.
And I decided that he would always move 20 squares, no matter what his destination was.
If he had to move one square, he would go the long way around.
It would probably involve the air and at least 3 trees.
The ability of being a jetpack that could transform into a monkey was kind of cool, though. He would jump onto people and grab onto their back. You know, the name of the move was Monkey on Your Back. Then transform into a jetpack and take off, carrying his passenger into the air. Then transform back into a monkey and let them go and have them drop.
I think he managed to do this once.
To Tomiko.
Who is immune to falling.
No, he did it to Amy, too.
Who is immune to falling. You can just see Zigzag up in the air going, oh!
He was so tired of these. Zigzag must have come to the conclusion that female humans don't take falling damage. He didn't hang out with any before that, you know? It was all the big Russian, or the big Swedish Bluebeard pirates.
There was an accent we hadn't manipulated yet.
Yeah.
Ophelia would have been ruined.
What else did they have? Slateface Uther, who was mostly generated by the photo that I wanted to use of him, which I think was Casey Jones. Like, super intense grimdark Casey Jones. You know, this guy also already wears a hockey mask. But he was just a big Swedish guy. He was the old captain of the Bluebeard Pirates before Captain Bluebeard took them over. Did I also give you guys...
Iggy and Spike, named after Bowser's kids. But in here, one of them was a woman.
Yeah, they were a married couple. Somewhat older. Oh, yeah, I remember they had the fun thing with the elephant gun.
One of them fired a gun, the other would reload it between turns.
Yeah. Spike would fire the elephant gun and then just uncock it and hold it out to the side so Iggy could load her special ammo in it. She had, like, moves that were, like, load special ammo for weird damage. That was kind of fun.
Well, it was a lot of fun to look at. Mm-hmm. And then every once in a while you look at Dave and go, Dave, you're playing this character. How do you feel just reloading someone else's gun every turn? And you're like, yeah, it's 11.
Which is basically the way she was.
Yeah.
Right. We should get to Bluebeard.
Yes. I was saving him. And then we had Captain Bluebeard.
He was a lot like Mr. Freeze visually.
Yeah, I actually used a picture of Mr. Freeze from, like, from DeviantArt that somebody had made.
His gimmick was basically a zombie whose muscle control was largely electrical impulses.
Yeah.
This is going to be real hard to do over a podcast, but imagine a guy moving like this.
Octodad.
Octodad's very good.
Yeah, he would, like, flail
Link
his...
Link to Octodad.
Yeah, he would flail his arms around... his whole thing was that he had died, but managed to, like, defibrillate himself back to life, but was, like, halfway dead. So he had this suit to keep his body from decomposing, and he was trying to get to the afterlife as well to get his soul back. But he had this really palsy-ish movement style where, like, one of the reasons why he had the jetpack monkey was to carry him around. I remember, to me, one of the most visually hilarious things was the idea of Zigzag grabbing onto Bluebeard and flying him through the air with his arms just flailing ragdoll-like from, the constant zigging back and forth of the monkey.
The only stage note Blake gave me for Bluebeard was unfailingly polite.
Ah, yes.
Which manifested magnificently, because during everybody else's conversation at the table, I would just be on the side quietly going, excuse me, I'd like to, no, you know, when you're finished, no, okay, can I, no, all right, I have something to, no, okay. Just a constant backdrop humming to the actual roleplay taking place at the table.
I knew that Hykov was the man for the job, that's why I gave him Bluebeard and ended up, and was trying to relegate the monkey to Alfred, but it was because there were only the five of them.
Mm-hmm. I, like Philip J. Fry, ended up doing two things.
The thing about that inability to move is that Bluebeard could move. I mean, it's the suit that he'd built allowed him to, you know, control his body with the impulses from his brain, but it was just wildly inaccurate. So he'd, you know, have these wide, flailing arm motions trying to fight somebody. But once he got a grip on you, then all he had to do was apply constant pressure, and he was actually super strong. So his big thing was grappling. When he finally caught you, you weren't going anywhere.
Yeah, he was the hydraulic man.
Yeah.
I want to say once he caught Jay. Jay grabbed him back, and they both went, oh no.
Whatever am I going to do? He had some kind of, like, crushing move or something, right?
Probably. Yeah.
Oh, right, he did cold damage with his cold body and stuff like that. There was also some cannibals on that island, including the cannibal witch doctor chief guy, who was kind of working against the party, I feel like, for much of the thing.
Because we can't have a D&D campaign without being racially insensitive at least once.
Sorry.
One says the South Texan.
Oh, fair enough.
What was the, like, there was a soul sucking out? Oh, right, yeah, there was the swords that suck people's souls out.
Yeah, but the witch doctor could just walk up to you and tear your soul out. That was a thing he did.
Right.
Yeah, he was scary.
Oh, Dr. We never Torso. Fought him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He tried to use the, soul tearing out move on Bluebeard, who of course had no soul, and was like, uh-oh, and then ended up getting killed by this magic, like, weapon that I had be a MacGuffin in the campaign that drains your soul out. But because he was so good at soul manipulation, Dr. Torso was, or the witch doctor was able to escape, but only his soul was pulled out of his body, but got sucked in from the waist down, and he was able to escape from the waist up. So after that, he was a ghost that stopped at the midsection, like running around on its hands, and we called him Dr. Torso.
Name exactly as stupid as One Piece canon. Main character's name is Monkey.
When they defeated
Monkey Rufy.
When they defeated Bluebeard's crew and managed to, like, beat them in their race to get to the afterlife, they ended up using some kind of soul ritual or something like that, I can't remember, to allow Dr. Torso to take over Bluebeard's body, but only from the waist up. So after that, the cannibal witch doctor had a new had a new body, you know, and Bluebeard's body, because he had been trying to get a soul so that his body could come back to life, came back to life. But the legs had a mind of their own. So as soon as he took over, he started, like, wiggling his legs all around, because the legs, Bluebeard's legs, were so happy that they were alive again. But Dr. Torso couldn't control them, so he just like, oh, I guess I'm going this way now, as the legs would walk off sideways. After that was the Underworld arc.
Which was long.
Yeah, I don't think we need to go into a tremendous amount of detail there. Maybe hit a couple of high points if there are.
Yeah. If there are, what asshole? There was all kinds of high points. Remember the Shame Ogre? The Shame Ogre was a super high point.
Did you come up with it while you were high?
The Shame Ogre was outstanding.
Shame Ogre came up in my campaign recently.
It's a meme now.
Just something popped up and said, "You can't hide from your shame." And the party animal companion went, "Oh no, not you again."
I based this afterlife on Dante's Inferno. I knew that they would need to go through different, like, circles of hell. But
about as true to Dante's Inferno as the video game Dante's Inferno.
Well, I mean,
loosely inspired by.
Yeah. Because in One Piece, you travel from island to island. So the afterlife was an ocean, and each circle of hell is indeed each level of purgatory, and each circle of heaven was a different island. And you needed a ship. They weren't able to bring their ship into the afterlife with them, so at first they commandeered Charon's boat, which Charon had super low amount of appreciation for.
Well, we commandeered Charon.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's what we said.
Yeah, Ophelia ended up devouring the boatman whole, which gave her psychic command of his undead crew and
Like with accountants.
And his undead ship.
That's how that works, right?
If you beat them in a game of riddles, you gain their power.
One of the funny things about the afterlife was everything was made out of souls. So what happened was, if your soul was sufficiently, like, weak, some stronger soul, or perhaps some tormentor of the afterlife, like a devil or an ogre, would walk over and compact you into a brick and use you to build, like, a house. And that was, I feel like, a source of some comedy where, like, all the bricks were people, and then, you know, you'd be like, "Hey, I can turn a brick back into a person." And be like, "Oh, did I go somewhere?" Or if you got really sick of somebody, be like, "Come here, you asshole, I'm gonna make you into a brick."
There's a whole lot of, what is the trope associated with, like, the unfortunate, not unfortunate implications, but...
"And I must scream."
There was a lot of that, too. A lot of the metaphysics of the afterlife are truly disturbing. You did a really good job.
It's the afterlife.
Yeah.
They got to fight. Oh, yes. They got to meet King Minos, the Minotaur King. There were four kinds of things in the afterlife besides dead guys. Devils, ogres, because it was a Japanese afterlife after all. Angels, because it was somehow a Christian afterlife as well. This all works together in One Piece. I'm not making this up. And, of course, Minotaurs, because, you know.
Because why not throw in... Hellenic pantheism.
I feel like there needed to be four things in, you know.
Four means death.
Yeah, exactly. And also, it was based on Dante's Inferno, so there was going to be a Minotaur or two. King Minos, King of the Minotaurs, was voiced by Dragon Ball Z abridged guru. I had a lot of fun when he said, "This is the true source of righteousness. Is righteousness," and challenged the party to a battle where all eight... Did we have 8 or 10 at the time? 8 characters got to fight this one level 30 solo at the same time.
What level 21.
You were level 21?
Yep.
Yeah. That was intense. It was not easy for them, but they did manage to pull it off. Afterwards, he was like, "Well, okay, I guess you're more righteous than me. You can just take command of the Palace of Minos, giant floating mobile oppression palace of the afterlife."
That's a later story.
Yeah. They met... devils. I named the devils after body parts. So, like, there was a shoulder devil. The joke being from, like, cartoons, when you've got an angel on one shoulder and a devil on the other shoulder. Shoulder devils would just become invisible and perch on your shoulder and give you bad advice. Or.
They were a good add to other fights because they could mess with your characters.
Lip devils.
Right.
Were mind flayers.
Yeah, and
because their lips were tentacles.
And chin devils, because you had all those Barbazoo minis that I wanted to use. Is that the right type?
Which is as good a reason as any.
Yeah.
That's why you guys were about to fight a whole bunch of Woodwodes last night.
Yeah, I kind of put two and two together with that. I was like, "Oh, the Woodwodes are totally coming out for this." What did your mom gave you 9 Woodwodes or something like that? No, you got them yourself.
It was real popular. It was a common during a time when I was getting a bunch of things.
Oh, so you just opened them all?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Not like Rust Monsters. Those were gifted. Yeah. Who wants Rust monsters? More importantly, who wants to give their players 10 Rust monsters and have a publicly findable address?
The, And then there were the hand devils, which were the ethereal filters. A lot of the devils were driven by miniature usage because, you know, the One Piece campaign being full of humans just really didn't leverage all those beautiful D&D minis we had very
the
often.
The skin devils weren't.
That's true. That was actually a World of Warcraft succubus, I think.
Yeah, the skin devils showed off a lot of skin.
Yeah.
The big scary ones were spine devils.
Yeah.
Because spine...
They were all named after a body part, but these guys were also, you know, their skin was spiny. It was easy to find spiny devil pictures on the internet for the program. And you really only did have, like, the two things that passed for spine devils, but it worked out. I don't know, I feel like the spine devils were kind of cool.
They were terrifying.
I feel like they were well-received.
They were terrifying.
Do you want to talk about the two mechanics that came in, the Ashley Riot mechanic and the companion character mechanic?
We'll discuss Ashley Riot...
At the
Delve Night session.
Yeah.
Tune in, Bat Reader.
Companion. Do you mean like the companion character thing we did when somebody was missing?
No,
the other one.
Oh, right. Yeah,
I think that's probably the cap off.
Yeah, we got about 20 minutes, so we better do that.
A companion character is something that was introduced in Dungeon Master's Guide 2. The idea is that you give it to somebody who is new and wants something to ramp up, or you use it to fill in for someone who's missing. It's a stripped-down version of a character. It has very few skills, almost no powers.
It's more like a monster than a character in terms of the 4th edition paradigm. A monster's just a list of abilities.
It really is. And the idea is that it's a much lower cognitive load to run, so you can give it to someone and say, play a character and a half. But we looked at this and said, we could actually do this for various purposes, because this is extensible to anything where you want half a character. This is a shonen thing. Everybody eventually splits off and fights their destined opponent. Sometimes you get it wrong. Spoilers. But the point is that everybody had to have a one-on-one fight, but D&D isn't designed for one-on-one fights. If you do get somebody who is an appropriate level, then they're built for a party, which means you need five of you. And even if there are five of you, well, then you're all five defenders. You have no healers. You have no strikers. Everything's built for a balanced party. So when we decided to split up for destined battles, because we were going to do this, by God...
Yeah, I mean, it was a thing that the One Piece campaign just really needed to have. We'd done it to a decent extent way, way earlier in the campaign when I introduced a bunch of... Back when it was a five-man party, I introduced a bunch of bad guys, one of which was only... Actually, two of which only popped up when the fight happened. But what we ended up doing was we had all five guys fight in the same room. And I made each monster really only solvable by the specific skills of one party member to sort of force a locking up of the appropriate player with the appropriate bad guy.
But now that we had more experience, more knowledge, and more finally someone published things that we want, we decided, okay, everybody, you're going to split up and have a destined battle. Come up with a couple of companion characters, just nubblings that will follow you around, half characters, and we'll distribute them. For example, Blake. You're going to fight your destined opponent, a shower. So, since you are a striker, come up with a companion defender, healer, and the third guy no one cares about, controller. And we will give those to the other three players at the table, and then we will have a four-on-one fight that's actually a one-on-one fight.
It was really magical the way we managed to, like, we did it a bunch of different ways. So, for example, when Amy was doing it,
because Amy was first, I think.
Yeah, Amy was one of the first ones. The companion characters were just different aspects of Amy's personality, and she only had one body in the fight. Whatever player was active at the time controlled the body. Of course, Dave was controlling Amy's, you know, core personality, her fully functional 4th edition character, so his turns were the most powerful. But there was also a defender turn, a defender turn, a controller turn, and a leader turn for, you know, it's like self-healing example.
Do you remember what they represented?
Body, mind, and spirit, I think was what I went with. Okay. Something like that, yeah.
For Klesk did the same
thing. Klesk did a very similar thing. It was because they're both, Amy and Klesk are both skirmisher types.
Right.
So it made sense to have one guy bouncing around four times per round.
It was no problem if you took four move actions. That's your job.
But I'm trying to think of somebody who actually had four bodies running around.
Jay, sort of.
Yes.
Jay and Katara were two really good examples. So Katara, being a Scion.
Ah, right.
Yeah. Or being a Sparkle Princess. Made three illusionary copies of herself.
Yeah, and that was a thing that she'd been doing all along, making illusionary copies of herself as a defensive move. But we actually said, okay, each illusionary copy is a guy. A whole functional version of herself. Because the damage she's dealing is psychic anyway, so even if it's made up... The point is, the real Katara is running around the room doing all this, but the bad guy sees four different Kataras that each seem to have their own way of hurting her.
She was also the only one where the main died, but then we just said that the one that survived was her all along.
Yeah. That was kind
very
of cool.
One piecey.
Yeah. Jay had... His backup characters were even more abstract. They were schemes.
They were things he had done around the area to prepare for the battle. One of his backup characters was the bar where the fight was happening.
Yeah,
actual physical place where he had, say, laid traps.
Yeah, he built various traps into the bar. Another one was the patrons of the bar, because this bar was not empty when this fight was happening, and he had, like, got a guy who owed him a favor to, you know, run up and punch the bad guy on that player's turn.
So, on Will's turn, he would run around and go, meh, a lot, and whip people with his chains. And on someone else's turn, a bottle would fly off the shelf and club someone in the head.
What were some of the other more interesting ones? What did Ophelia... Oh, right, Ophelia had tentacle masses.
Yeah.
She just decided, this room doesn't have enough me in it, and sprouted three large masses of tentacles, each of which had a different job. One of them was stabby tentacles. She was the leader, so that helped. One of them was focused on just being a cushy mass for things to hit.
I guess one of the neat things about it was, I feel a little bad about, like, categorizing the players... In a hierarchy, but you know that's how One Piece does it too. There's the weaker members of the party, and they would move up to the stronger members of the party, having a fight last.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the things that we did as well, where we knew that Tomoko and Bison, who were the two kind of forerunners for being potentially the captain, were going to go as the last two. But right before Tomoko, actually, maybe we did Tom towards the beginning, didn't we?
I think we
did. Because he was part of the lesser half of the party.
Right. Okay. But Tom already had extra bodies.
Tom had 9 personalities, and whenever I did stuff with them, I would form a spirit amalgam of all these guys that would go out and do things. Well, I fought a guy whose job was wearing different hats, literally. He would put on this hat, and now he would be an accountant. He would put on this hat, and now he would be a fireman, because that's how hats work. And he decided, okay, let's punch the personalities straight out of you. And he just wound up, did a power, and knocked all of them out of me. And then there were 10 versions of me on that field, at which point the guy went, this didn't go as planned.
Did we give...
Each of us got one, but they rotated.
Yeah, each of you got one. He sucked the other six back into the spirit amalgam. So there was the spirit amalgam running around, Tom's main body,
and three of the other ones.
Orphaned spirits running around doing their own thing.
And when Heiko used a power that would use one of the powers of one of the outstanding guys, everyone rotated.
Yeah, that guy got sucked into the spirit amalgam, and a random one got spat out. Again, you could use a D6 for this.
All of the powers were... color-coded, because they did things based on the personality. So I said, I need to use the orange thing now. Who's orange? Dave is? No, you're not. Give me orange. I'm using that power, and you get your pink now.
Yeah. That was a really, really cool fight.
And we all tried to role-play the personalities of the characters that we got. I thought we did a pretty good job.
I gave everybody one-word, not even elevator pitch. This one was a pass-on-the-stairs pitch for what was the personality you're going to be. Unfortunately, the rapid-fire delivery character... The word I used for that was distraction. So whenever I gave it to Will, he would just stare off into space until Blake called him for the fourth or fifth time. Like, I should have used a different word.
Yeah.
It was still funny.
Right.
It was really
funny. Hyperactive. Yeah. Will would have gotten that right. Anyway, so then at the end, the two last ones were Tomoko and Bison in that order, because Bison at the time we decided was going to go ahead and be the one that we gave the captain seat for this.
He was also fighting the most powerful bad guy.
Yeah. The boss of all the other bad guys, Satan himself. Anyway, the
it was a weird campaign.
Well, they were all devils. It was the afterlife. So Tomoko was actually pretty good, because Tomoko's fight was multi-stage.
I designed 10 companion characters. Oh wait,
no more than that,
and 9 for Tom.
Yeah. Wait, did Tomoko make 10?
Yeah,
3 for each stage.
And 4 for one stage.
Okay. Right, because you companion characterized yourself for the last stage.
First it was the middle stage. Running around and fighting a whole bunch of minions. I got ruined there.
Yeah.
Then the enemy got into his mech, and I went, ah, good thing I prepared for this.
Well, it was the tanks first, actually, but I think that's when he talked about getting ruined.
We got rollicked.
Yeah, you were in your tank. He was in his tank.
Things got real interesting when we went to the mecha versus mecha combat.
This is like Godzilla-sized mecha robot. It was really great, too, because the bad guy had been working on building this, you know, giant mecha all along. And then Tomica was like, aha, but I have also been building a giant mecha all month. And so her giant mecha got summoned, and they had a big giant mecha punching contest.
The picture was great. It was giant Nene versus robot Cthulhu.
Yeah. Yeah, because their bad guy was a lip devil, so he was a mind flayer with the tentacle mouth, and yeah, unfortunately that fight was really cool, but just you know things didn't break nicely.
I also got rollicked.
Yeah, the Cthulhu robot made the mistake of devouring Tomiko Bot's head. Die Tomiko was the one we called it.
That's where I was.
Yeah, so he devoured the head in the manner that a mind flayer does, which caused the pilot to be ejected into his own cockpit. Where, you know,
round three,
she could melee him.
This combat ends when I want it to end.
Right. And then, of course, Heiko had the three different subsystems. Was it still subsystems?
Nope.
What did you do for that one?
I had Tomiko with one person playing as Tomiko's pirate personality,
right,
the Pink Knight. One playing as Gabrielle Tomiko, Noble.
Right.
And one as...
Ensign Everglade.
The Marine personality.
Right.
I was half rogue.
That was a lot of fun.
I manipulated the system so hard for that one.
Right.
I disabled some filters. And last was Bison.
Yeah. So Bison went a little bit weird, because Bison had all along had this companion character in...
Simon.
Simon, yeah. Who Simon was actually just a power. Of Bison's. Yep. He was a reskin of a power, right?
He was basically Oliver Twist.
Yeah. He was a little British orphan. Will really enjoyed doing his British boy accent, and he always called everyone sir.
I promise it's better than Blake's.
It was?
It would have to be.
Okay, well, anyway...
My cats have a better British accent than you do.
Right. So what happened at the beginning was Bison went in to fight Satan the Devil, and immediately got, like, picked up, a backbreakered and thrown into a pool of super kill you acid. Like, not just regular acid, super kill you acid.
Like flaming lava spike acid of poison death.
Yeah, Mega Man is used to this kind of thing. Mario is used to this kind of thing. Sonic is not. So the, at that point it was like, oh no, what has happened? And at that moment, Simon came crawling out of Bison's bottomless bag, wearing the giant mech suit that had belonged to the boss of... the previous Everybody Split Up and Fight a Different Guy arc. And that mech suit had three subsystems, not unlike Tomiko's mecha.
There was a dynamo, there was a coolant system.
Yeah, because it had cold damage,
fire
damage and lightning damage, yeah. Flamethrower, dynamo, and coolant system.
That was interesting because Simon was there to soften up the bad guy before Bison showed up.
Right.
The issue was that Simon was really, really good. Things broke for him. I, in particular, played magnificently as the dynamo. And the guy just kept spending second wins he didn't have. That guy was on his sixth healing surge by the time Simon finally fell and Bison rejoined the fight, going, okay, now it's time for... You're dead! Please revive!
I remember we ended up kind of canceling Simon by caveat, yeah. So that we could have the Bison part of the fight. And then when Bison rejoined, what were his companions?
Freaking wacky, that's what they were.
Legs? Was everybody a leg?
They might have all been legs. At that point, we even played with initiative.
Yeah.
Like, I would only get a turn...
Right.
...as a free action after a successful attack.
I think you were the Destiny, weren't you? Or something like that?
Primary Bison.
No, it was the juggling. Yeah, one of them was... One of you was specifically for juggling. Where, like, after a move was delivered, you got an interrupt turn to, like, do juggling moves as you kicked him into the air or punched him into the air or whatever.
Where that got most interesting was the domination power that the bad guy had. At one point, he took me over. So every time Bison hit, I would then attack Bison. with 10 attacks, each of which could knock him unconscious, dealing 30 damage to me.
Oh, yeah, that was the other thing.
I think that eventually ended when he knocked his legs unconscious and had to revive them.
It was definitely pretty wacky. I remember that was one of the things we had.
It was a fantastic one-piece final fight.
Yeah, the damage distribution was a thing, because every time there was a body-sharing fight, basically the damage was who wants it. When damage was coming in, one of the parts would say, "I volunteer to take this damage," which was usually the defender until it was almost dead, and then the other ones would start taking damage.
I might as super hard in the Tomiko one.
Yeah.
Where I immediately got bloodied, which tripled my damage, and then let everybody else take damage for me.
Yeah, that was very good. That was pretty cool. So, at about to be 7 o'clock, are there any other good ones that we missed from that campaign?
No, I mean...
That was every good story.
Did I have you guys fight a giant enemy crab followed by a bigger giant enemy crab?
Yes.
And the whole story is therefore revealed.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those things where there were a lot of really epic fights, as there are. I think one of the things that came out of this was we between Heiko and myself and maybe some other characters, we sort of figured out the best way to play the character that is mechanically broken. And that, especially in this type of campaign, it's like, yes, Tomiko can drop 200 damage in a round. Because she's a true badass, she doesn't.
Yeah.
Unless she has to. Unless someone's going to hurt one of her friends.
And every single time, before I do it, I knock someone prone and point at them and say, "Hey, cut it out."
Yeah.
One of the many character tropes I've taken from Freakazoid.
Fun and Games has moved to the University Mall.
Yes. We know. We're right here.
I'm telling the viewers. The listeners. Shut up. This is a thing that I do, too, I realized just now. And I was like, yes, and some healing. I held my arm out sideways and, like, waved my hand in a dismissive way. Like, shut up, honey. I'm doing a podcast right now. I don't have time for your woman problems.
Oh, geez. This hat is round and my head is not. No angle fits. Also, it's stuck in my hair.
Be like, why does this smell like someone else has touched it? I, like a mother bird, can smell when someone has molested my hat.
This podcast is fully copyrighted by its hosts. Visit us at podcastmagicmissile.com. I podcast Magic Missile, attacking the darkness since 2012.
Let's do it to the beat.
Anyway, going back to what I was saying.